few words of wisdom for us. So thanks, Elisa. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Elisa, compulsive overeater, and so I just wanted to share what it was like, what happened, and how it is now. So I grew up in Detroit. I moved there when I was 6 months old. I'm the fourth of 10 children, and had a very happy childhood. We didn't have a TV, and so we were constantly playing outside, constant activity, constant games. And my mom stayed at home my entire life, and my dad worked. And so as far as my compulsive overeating, it started very young. I was really young when I didn't realize it at the time, but I, growing up, my mom was very strict about food and very health conscious, and she would just buy fruits and vegetables and lean protein and never any, like, we barely ever went out to eat or we barely ever got any sort of junk food. So when there was junk food, I loved it and did a lot of seeking of it. One time, like, we got Valentine's Day candy from our from school. Like, people would sign up and give you candy, like Jolly Rancher sticks, and I ate all mine, like, in the first day, of course. And my sister, who's not as close of an eater, she kept hers in a bag in her drawer, and we shared a room. And I remember taking some of hers. I couldn't help it. Like, I needed that sugar. But because of that, like, I was always thin growing up. I participated a lot in sports. My family was pretty standard to play all three sports, like fall sport, winter sport, and spring sport. And then usually, I mean, because we were so active, like, weight was never an issue for me until I moved to France to study abroad. But there's definitely, looking back at my childhood, there's definitely that sugar-seeking behavior. And I didn't realize that I was different. Like, I thought everyone had it. But I do have a lot of siblings who never had any issues with it. And my dad, so both sides of the family, there's isms on the both sides of the family. My maternal great-grandfather passed away of alcoholism. There's a book written about that family. They worked in the clothing mills in New Hampshire, turn of last century, and they had a lot of Quebecois. People from Quebec had migrated down to New Hampshire, Manchester, New Hampshire, to work in the clothing mills. And my great-grandfather, maternal great-grandfather, passed away, I think he was like 39 or 40, from alcoholism. And he left my grandmother with, she had just had her 12th child. And so, obviously, that was a big stress on her to have 12 children and no husband. And it was around the time of the Great Depression, I think. So my grandmother, Lorette, she was one of the 12, and she went on to have 8 children in Manchester, New Hampshire, and my mom, Denise, is one of them. But a lot of, so my, that side of family is very Catholic, and a lot of the men became priests, but they were a lot of them were alcoholic. And a lot of them went into recovery for alcoholism later on. And then, so my mom never drank because there's that fear of drinking. And then my dad, both of my dad's parents were alcoholics. And once my grandfather died, and he was a really, really active alcoholic, my grandmother was by herself in Ohio, and she actually got, I don't know if it was arrested or what, she had this VW bug, and she crashed it, and she was drunk. And so after that, she came to live with us, and I really bonded a lot with my grandmother, and she asked my father, who was also an alcoholic, but I didn't know that, because he never drank, which was weird, but he never drank around us. He would drink on business trips and stuff. And then my grandmother asked my father to take her to her first AA meeting back in, I think, the 90s, early 90s. So my dad took my grandmother to her first meeting, and then through that, my dad started his journey in recovery, OA, AA, GA, a lot of A's. So that was around the time when I was in high school that was going on, that my grandmother was getting into recovery, and then my dad was getting into recovery. So it was really confusing to me because my dad was like a closet drinker. Like, he worked for Ford, and they would go on business trips, and he felt safe drinking then. But, like, the liquor cabinet in our house, there was never anything gone from that. Like, it had been there for decades and dusty and nothing gone. So he didn't drink at home, but he did eat at home. But it was kind of hard to eat in my house, like, overeat my household, because there wasn't really anything to binge on. But I do remember when I was in high school, I would, like, eat brown sugar clumps and raisins and whole wheat crackers. Like, but I thought that was, like, a binge. I mean, not a binge, but, like, that kind of satisfied my and then, of course, once I got to high school, like, there were vending machines. And then even in grade school, like, going to Little League Baseball, when we walked there, we walked past the corner store, and there's a bakery that we used to walk past. And it was always a goal to get, like, some sort of sugar from that store without my parents knowing about it. So there wasn't, like, physical manifestations of the disease. I was always really thin, but I was eating as much as I could possibly get my hands on. And then in my sophomore year, I went over to France for an exchange program. Oh, no, my junior year. And that was the first time anyone had, in my whole family, had been over to Europe. And I really emotionally, like, I was having a lot of fun. But, like, my high school, I was in Strasbourg. Well, I lived in a village outside of Strasbourg, but then I took the train into Strasbourg, and there's an international high school. And they had, their schedule was more like on a college schedule, so there were breaks in between. You could leave the campus, and there's a bakery right across the street. And so we would go there, and then just the food, how rich it was and how delicious it was, I didn't hold back. And I've never been around that much access to junk food. And I remember my host mom used to keep, like, 6 packs of candy bars in the living room drawer. And I would eat them all. And she'd be like, what? Like, what happened to all my candy bars? And any chance I got, I would eat. And I packed up pounds then. And we were in Paris on a vacation. They were going to go to the tennis match there, the famous tennis match, I forget what it's called, but we were sitting at breakfast in the hotel, and my host mom made a comment about my weight, and I went upstairs in the hotel room, and I just, like, whacked myself in the bathroom and was crying because someone had finally said something about it. And when I got home from France, I went down to meet my family, and my family didn't even recognize me. I put on so much weight. And then within a month or two, because the limited access to food and my exercising, like, I was back down to, like, 105 pounds, and that's my senior year, and then I went to college, and I was still really active, so college and medical school and residency, I didn't really have a weight issue, but I definitely had a food problem, like, you know, any sort of test, any sort of long period of studying, I rewarded myself by getting a lot of food and binging on it. College was, you know, I pretty much maintained my same weight. And I never really had a problem with alcohol except for last year of college. It was really stressful for me because I didn't know what I was going to do. And my boyfriend and I were about to get engaged. And I remember we were going to a dance together. And before he got there, like, I had most of a bottle of wine. And I ended up throwing up at the dance. And at that point, like, I hadn't really been drinking a lot. But that really scared me. And I decided to give up drinking. And I, since that time, I haven't really drank more than, like, four drinks a year, probably. But just because it was really scary with my family history. And so I always thought, like, great, I dodged the bullet. I don't have an alcohol problem, where a lot of my siblings probably do have an alcohol problem. But I didn't realize, like, food was essentially the same problem, and I was using it in the same way to dampen down my feelings and reward myself and to cover myself. So then I went to medical school, and medical school is just crazy in terms of, like, the time it takes to, I mean, you're pretty much constantly studying. And I would reward myself by going to the vending machine, or when it got into rotations and I was going, like, 36 hours on, a lot of the hospitals, they would give you a pass to their cafeteria where you could just literally get anything you wanted for free. And those months were especially hard, especially if it was, like, OBGYN, where I was up most of the night, because lack of sleep was definitely a trigger for me for eating. And but still, like, I weighed, I was a normal, healthy weight. I was just moving so much and throughout the day, and but I was eating a lot. Throwing up has never been a part of my story. Laxative use I have. I didn't realize that that's what I was doing. That probably lasted about 6 months of all of this towards the end. But so medical school, then residency, maintained a healthy weight through residency, but a lot of binging, no purging. I mean, other than just, like, a lot of movement through the day just because I was so active. And throughout this, because my dad had so much recovery, I would occasionally think, like, I should go to OA, but I never did. I always felt embarrassed about it, about admitting that I had a problem. Like, no, I'll fix it myself. And then I moved up to Ketchikan in 2009 straight from residency, and I started here, and I was full-time. Oh, and the boyfriend, we were engaged, but he really wanted to have kids, like, right away. And I just didn't feel like that was fair because I knew I wanted to go to medical school, and his mom was a doctor, and so he knew how it was. And so I ended up calling that off, and I'm really glad I did, because he was Hindu and I was Catholic, and it, which has just been really hard. But throughout that time, like, there were guys, and there were probably, like, three or four, like, possible marriage situations, but because I was so busy, I didn't really spend a lot of time with that. So then I moved up to Ketchikan, and I was full-time here, and it was just crazy busy covering everything at the hospital, really, really intense. But my eating continued, and it was just work, eat, sleep, work, eat, sleep. And then two years into residency, I started having really a heavy period. I didn't really address it at all because I wasn't doing much self-care. I was like, oh, it'll get better. But it turned out I had 8 really, 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 really big fibroids in my uterus. And so that got progressively worse. And when I got up here the first year, like, I was bleeding so much that I was fainting. I couldn't stand up. And, like, but of course, no, it will just go away. I don't have to, like, admit it. It'll be fine. And finally, it got to the point I was on. It was 8th of March, 2010. I got up to take a call to go into the ER. And I stood up from my bed up really fast and just, like, fell over. I was able to crawl. I was living in a duplex. And I was able to crawl up to my renter's door and asked her to take me to the hospital, and she did. And I ended up being in a room right next to the patient I was supposed to be seeing. And it was so bad. My hemoglobin was like 5. And like, they started blood transfusions right away. And they're like, there's no way we can even get you to Seattle. Like, you're so critical. And luckily there were 2 OBGYNs in the hospital, really good OBGYNs. And they did like emergency operation on me and removed all 8 of them. And I'm so grateful that they were there, because they did an awesome job. And the female OBGYN came to my room the next day, and she was like, you know, if you want to have kids, you better get started now. And I'm like, what do you want me to do? Like, go to a bar, pick up men? Like, I'm single, in the middle of nowhere, Alaska. I work all the time. Like, what am I supposed to do? And of course, like, when I was told that I couldn't have kids, like, it became, like, my main focus. Because it was like, if you tell me I can't do something, at first I wanted to have children, and I was so mad at myself for, like, letting the best child-rearing years of my life get away with, like, this obsession over medicine. So I was on an online dating thing, but I had never taken the time to look at it. So when I was recovering from that surgery, my dad came up from Florida, and he was with me, and I started looking at it, and there was this guy who actually went to church with me that I had been looking at in church, and then 2 and 2 together, like, we met over this match, and he was like, hey, let's hang out. Like, we were, like, and I totally fell in love with him, like, head over heels in love with him. The problem is, he was 10 years younger, because on the dating site, like, type in your age range that you want, and I typed in, like, 30 to 40, and one guy showed up, and it was actually this guy's brother, and so I was like, okay, I'm gonna have to increase my range, so I did 20 to 50, and, like, 4 guys showed up, including this guy that I fell in love with, and I explained the situation to him, and, like, we totally head over heels, like, he's the guy I love, like, out of all the guys I've had relationships with, he's the best. And, but finally it got to the point where he wanted to have a bunch of kids, and that was great for him, but, like, finally he decided to end it, and it was really sad. But then he introduced me to his friend from, Prince of Wales, and, so we got together, and, we were able to get pregnant, and, but meanwhile, like, I'm Catholic, and this is, like, all against everything in the Catholic religion. And so I'm eating over it still, and I get pregnant, and then I have to go on bed rest, and it's, like, the best thing that ever happened, but it came about in a very willful, like, I want this, who cares what God wants away, and which was very sad to me, and, like, I feel guilty about, and I'm working on forgiveness with it, but anyway, that happened. And then, so we had a very healthy, happy boy, June of 13. And then, I was supposed to be halftime at work when I went back from my maternity leave. And I had a contract that I had signed for halftime. And they were okay with it. But for the next 5 or 6 years, they forced me with the implication that I would be fired if I didn't work what they wanted me to. So it was closer to 3/4 time to full time, and they weren't paying me for the extra work, and they were forcing me to work extra. So I was just a mess. I was trying to take care of Joseph, and I was trying to be a mom, and I was trying to do everything that they wanted me to. What happened was there was another doctor who was hired around the same time that I went on maternity leave, and she she had debilitating migraines to the point where she wouldn't be there for like 2 weeks out of the month or 3 weeks out of the month. So I was covering her. She was getting paid for full-time work at home most of the time, and I was there, and they were paying me half-time. And so it was just a really, really, really toxic work situation. So, but despite that, it was really fun because Joseph was here, and but my eating started to pick up, and I wasn't doing the amount of activity that I was used to, and so I started to pass down the pounds, and we were over at POW. I was coming home from visiting over with Joseph's dad's family, and my dad had given me the 12 steps. No, OA 12 and 12, but on CD, and I just happened to put it in, and this was May of 14, so 11 months after Joseph was born, and I put it in the CD. I was driving down the road in Prince of Wales, and it just came to me. I was like, Alisa, you need to ask for help with this. Like, it's okay, you have a problem, and you need to ask for help. And the next week, I went to the OA meeting here and sat down and really felt at home and was able to ask for help, and I'm really grateful that Leslie's kept the OA meeting here running so long, and so that was the point where, for the first time in my life, I asked for help with something, and I was able to open up and be vulnerable and say, I can't do this by myself, and so the work situation continued to get worse. I had my review, my annual review in June of 17, and I talked to the medical director. I was like, we have to get this fixed. I can't continue to work three-fourths time or full-time and not get paid for it. And he's like, Alisa, if you don't work at my beck and call, you're not following the mission of Peace Health. The mission of Peace Health is Catholic, and he knows that I'm Catholic. He knows that I had a child out of wedlock, and I felt really guilty about it. And, of course, I just continued until it got to the breaking point where I was working, like, full-time in February of 2018. And I emailed the CAO of Peace Health, and I told him what was going on. And he said, not only will we follow your contract, but we'll give you back pay. So I got a check for back pay within a week, and they were going to follow my contract. And then my medical director here fired me without cause, which was horrible. But it's then investigate the skies, especially with what's going on now. But it was abusive, and I put up with it for way too long. And so I got fired in March of 18, and then May of 18, I went to Juneau, and for an OA retreat, and we saw a whale breach, and then I it was a really good retreat, and I had a thought then, like, I've been here 10 years, I've never seen a whale breach like that. It was right next to the shrine, and I was like, if you can, when else are you going to have that? And so I decided to get off flour and sugar that day, and I've been off flour and sugar since. It's a miracle, and I'm very grateful for it because it has really helped me through this hard time of being fired. But through that firing, because I didn't really have much to do because I was fired, I just was starting my own private practice. But I just started working the program and just, really, especially what's been most important for me, despite being, other than being off of flour and sugar, has just been forgiveness of myself for having a child out of wedlock, which you're not supposed to do, forgiveness for the medical director who abused me during that time, and forgiveness of a lot of people, and just, I've prayed for people. Like, the person has everything that they want, everything that I would want for myself for 14 days. And some people have done it for 14 days times 3 or 14 days times 4. And it's really, really, really helped me get to the point where I can still live in a small town where there's been a lot and it's lifted those resentments. Like, now when I see the medical director who fired me in the grocery store, you know, I don't have hard feelings towards him. I feel like I have forgiven him for what he did. And I do wish that he has everything that he could possibly want, and I do wish that he doesn't get COVID. But myself, and the other thing with, like, having a child out of wedlock, like, we're still going to church, and but I felt really far away from God. And through the work through OA, it's, like, it provided a platform to, like, bring me close to God again, not in, like, a traditional way that I would have if I had gone through the church, but, like, and so I do feel like there has been forgiveness around being very willful and, like, going headfirst into having a child come hell or high water. And there's just been a lot of forgiveness around it. And on a day-to-day basis, like, growing my practice, I've just really seen on a day-to-day basis, like, I'm provided for, my family's provided for, all is well. It's okay. Like, sometimes, I've totally gone over 20 minutes. Do you guys let me stop? It's 26 minutes. I'm almost done. So
you're great. Go ahead.
Okay. It's just been a very, very powerful 2 years. Just the using the 12 steps and having, I guess what I'm grateful for is I've had so much material with which to use the 12 steps, you know. And there's been so much where I've just had to, like, just trust in God and just take the next right step and just really walk out in faith, doing some pretty scary stuff, like going into business by myself, doing a private practice, but I see step by step that I provided for and that I'm taken care of, and that I can trust that that's going to last day by day for the rest of my life, and I don't have to be paralyzed by fear, and I don't have to turn to the food for help, and I can turn to others. That's been amazing. I'm a total introvert, and I've always thought, like, I could just do it myself. I'll do it myself, but in turning, May of 14, when I admitted to myself that I needed help, it's just been opening up of asking for help, accepting help, giving help, and realizing that I don't have to do things all by myself. I can ask for help and accept help, and that is a better way to do it than just be headstrong and butt my head up against a lot of different walls. As far as my food plan is concerned, it's just no sugar, no flour. I try not to eat chips, but sometimes I eat chips. And then I was 225 pounds. That was the most that I've ever been, and that happened when I was fired. That was the weight I was when I was fired. That was the weight in May when I went to Juno, and I'm down to, like, 185, 90 pounds now, which is really nice. And I'm thankful to my dad for going before me and by his example telling me that it's okay to ask for help. And I'm grateful for all of you who have been on this journey with me. And I can't think of anything else to say. Oh, one last thing I think I would say is my dad told me early when he found out I was going to LA, he's like, there are podcasts from the OA LA intergroup that I really appreciate, and those have been very, very integral in my recovery process. And I think I will pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, now we could have questions if people would like to ask her questions. Perfect. Thank you. Would anybody like to ask questions?
Elisa, can you hear me? This is Leslie from Juno.
Yes.
Yeah, so thank you for your story. That's really powerful. I just wanted to hear about how your concept of higher power has developed or changed over the time that you've been in OA.
Thank you for that. I think because I came from such a dogmatic place with religion. Now, granted, I had been engaged in Hindu, and I do have experience with a lot of other religions in the world, so I had that. I wasn't, like, very strict, necessarily, but when I had a child out of wedlock, like, it was blatantly against, like, anything that my religion teaches. So I think with my concept of a higher power, like, how I pictured myself when I went to church was, like, I had fallen from grace, basically. And I picture myself like that in life, too. And I feel like in 12-step programs, it's okay if you've fallen from grace. It's okay if you've done a lot of things. Like, one of the things with me, with listening to podcasts, is, like, people fail miserably in a lot of different ways, and then they come to recovery, and there is grace, and there is redemption. So I feel like I was at a really low bottom spiritually, and, like, when I would go to church, like, the ideal was, like, way up here, and I was way down there. But I feel like OA in giving me, like, that opportunity to define a higher power and to, like, get close to God is, like, allowance to get close to God again, despite all my failures. And so now I feel like I'm back on par with other people, and I feel like my higher power, like, I don't necessarily have a definition per se, but I know that there is a higher power helping me on a day-to-day basis, and I am 100% certain of that because of how my life has gone. There's someone else other than me helping me. I can't really think about it. I can't really think of anything else to say on that, but it has really helped me that despite anything, literally anything that I could have done, there is still love and acceptance. So maybe love and acceptance is my higher power. But I do still believe in and go to Catholic Church, and I feel accepted there. But I think it's because now I accept myself. I don't think anyone there was not accepting me. I think it was an inside job, and now I feel like I am connected to my higher power in a way that I wasn't before OA. And that's the end of my answer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? I'm sure there are none. This is Barbara from Cincinnati. I don't really have a question. I just so agree with what you're saying. I so appreciate your concept and your willingness to just come forward and see yourself and show yourself to us. Thank you. It's so nice to meet
you. Thank you, Barbara.
Hi, Elise. This is Karen from Juneau. Thank you so
Hi,
much
Karen.
For your thank you so much for your story. I really appreciate it. And I really related to your comments about wanting to do it all yourself. It's actually caused a yo-yo effect in my abstinence over a series of years. Given that, what is your relationship like with your sponsors and your commitment to meetings?
So in May of 14, when that whale breached, and I was actually, Leanne was driving me to the grocery store when I had that realization, like, this is a great time to start an abstinence. But our speaker was from San Diego or just outside of LA, I forget exactly where, but she held up a journal that from Region 1. And I had several of the journals at home, and she held it up and said, this has been a huge part of my recovery. I write in it every day. And since that retreat, I have written in that journal just about every day. At first I wasn't doing this, but what I'm in the habit of doing now is I write, like, it's a 10-step journal and gratitude and readings, and then I take a picture of it and I email it to my sponsor every morning so she can see, like, if I need to do a 10-step, I'll do it, or, like, a gratitude list, and then I list my food there. So that has been really, a really big part of my recovery. And then meetings, we have a Saturday morning meeting here. During this time of COVID, we have been having a nightly phone meeting, which has been really nice. But for the first year at the private practice, like, I wasn't affiliated with the clinic, and I was pretty much doing everything myself in terms of work. I was by myself a good part of the day. And then I'd see, like, two or three patients. And, but pretty much throughout the time I was alone, I was either listening to podcasts, I was listening to OA phone meetings. It was, like, some sort of OA podcast or phone meeting was my constant companion throughout that whole year. And this year, I've been busier because I am a 1099 with a clinic now. But, so I haven't done that as much. But I really appreciate podcasts, OA podcasts, AA podcasts, any kind of recovery podcast, and then meetings, like phone meetings on the phone, the main phone line where they have the marathons, where it's like 24/7 meetings on holidays. That phone line, I call that often for meetings. So that's as far as my sponsor. Communication is daily through taking a picture of my journal and then going to as many meetings as I can here, but then also using phone meetings and podcasts almost obsessively just to kind of hear that recovery has been really important for me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We probably have time for another question. Hi, this is Bonnie in Juneau, a compulsive eater.
Hi, Bonnie.
Just thank you so much for your story. Too many of us have a Catholic story, and I am a practicing Catholic now, but I did marry out of the church, and I thought I destroyed my family. But I want to thank you for just one statement, and I can't do this alone, and I try too often to do it alone, and one of my resistances is right. but thank you for saying I cannot do this alone.
Thank you, Bonnie. I do have one thing to add about writing. There's a book called The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron, who was in recovery herself, and then she wrote a book about writing and creativity, and she has a tool in there called The Morning Pages. And The Morning Pages, so it's basically 3 pages of longhand writing done when you first wake up as sort of just a way to clean out your mind. And then, so I have developed this thing where I do morning pages. So when I wake up in the morning, I write the date down on a yellow piece of paper, and it has to be a yellow piece of paper. I have a bunch of yellow paper. And then I write, good morning, higher power. How can I be of service today? What would you have me do? What's the best next indicated step? And then I do as much as I can writing. But one thing that I found with that, and I carry it around with me all day, and if I've ever come to a sticking point where I have to call my sponsor, I have to reach out for help, I usually start by writing, good afternoon, higher power, what would you have me do? How can I best be of service? What's the next best indicated step? And then I write down whatever comes to my mind, and sometimes I have to, like, stop everything I'm doing and take a picture of the writing and email it to my sponsor if it's something that I really need help with. But one thing that I found with those morning pages is I have a shredder, and once it gets full, I just shred it, and it's such a good feeling to shred it because I'm just letting it go. But it's a way for me to write throughout the day, and I like it because it's yellow so I can see it from anywhere. And I oftentimes during the day, if I'm struggling with something, will come back to that, do some centering writing, and then see what comes to me and just write it down. It's a good sounding board for myself throughout the day, and it follows me wherever I am, whatever I'm working on, and then it's best when the page is full and I can shred it.
What a great idea, Lisa. This is Cindy. I really appreciate you sharing that idea on writing, because I'm not very good at writing or journaling, and those are some ideas that I may try. So it looks like we're 4 minutes till 11 o'clock. Does anybody have anything else, or should we wrap up? Okay. The opinions expressed here today by those of us who shared, and thank you so much, Elisa, for all of your heartfelt sharing, and everybody else as well, are not our own and not necessarily those of OA as a whole. Please remember our commitment to honor each other's anonymity. What you see here, whom you see here, when you leave here, let it stay here.
Here.
Thank you for allowing me to be your leader today by following the 12 steps, attending regular meetings, and using the OA tools. We are changing our lives. You will find hope and encouragement in Overeaters Anonymous. After a moment of meditation, will those who wish to please join us in closing with the Serenity Prayer.